Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. As you all know, this is the last Wednesday evening of the 2001 Wassa Rains Retreat. So this will be the last Wednesday evening talk in the Wassa. And for this evening's talk, I wanted to talk about Awija. I was talking about this with the Anagarikas last night, and so some of the terminology would be fresh in their minds. And I wanted to talk about this because it is a crucial aspect of the Buddhist Dhamma. It is the root cause of all the problems of suffering and of birth, old age, sickness and death. In the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, which we chanted a few moments ago, the Second Noble Truth in that sutta was described as the cause of suffering being craving, dhanha. However, in other suttas, the Buddha expands or deepens the explanation of the Second Noble Truth, the cause of suffering, to refer to the whole of the 12 links of dependent origination, Paticca Samuppada, and the origin of even craving, when you find the causal links which show how craving arises, would always come from avijja. And so that one can quite legitimately say that not just the cause of suffering is craving, but the cause of suffering is also avijja. They use the saying very often in the suttas, blinded by avijja, fettered by craving. The untaught ordinary person just wanders from birth to birth, place to place, sometimes feeling delight, sometimes feeling suffering, but never being free from the problems of existence. And so I wanted to focus this evening on avijja, and of course to focus on the end of avijja, that how avijja is destroyed, how it is annihilated. You might say that the Buddha did teach annihilation. He taught the annihilation of the defilements, especially the annihilation of avijja. You noticed already that I'm not translating that term. Sometimes people translate it as ignorance, but that really doesn't fit the Pali meaning of the term. Ignorance is something which you abolish at school, or you annihilate through reading books. And many people have gone to schools, many people have read books, many people have got PhDs in Buddhism, but they haven't annihilated or destroyed avijja. It's more than just ignorance. And so I'd like to keep it as avijja for the time being. I think you all know that my preferred rendering for that term is delusion, and I'll bring that out later on in this talk. But as we also chanted in the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, there has always been understood in Buddhism that enlightenment is somehow a seeing of a hidden truth, seeing things in a different way. And that seeing, that insight, that enlightenment insight, is something which actually changes just the whole cognitive process, the whole way we perceive and see this world. In particular, by seeing clearly, then we won't go around craving for things in the same way that a person would not go putting their hand in a fire once they know that it hurts. It's because of delusion that we keep on putting our hands in the fires of the sensory realm. So, to understand what avijja is, to really get to the root of it, it's instructive to know that even though the Buddha never said that avijja has a first cause, he did actually say that avijja has nutriments, has things which support it and keep it going. And those things which keep avijja going are the five hindrances. These five hindrances are fundamental to the practice of Buddhism. And you can put the practice of Buddhism, the purpose of the Eightfold Path, down to the overcoming of these five hindrances. First of all, overcoming them temporarily, and then overcoming them permanently. Because we're overcoming these five hindrances, the five hindrances of interest in the world of the five senses, sometimes called sensory desire, ill will towards a person, a being, or even a mental state, sloth and torpor, the dullness of the mind, the lack of energy, the restlessness and remorse of the mind, never being able to find contentment, and of course doubt. These five hindrances are those things which support, generate and fuel avijja. This is one of the reasons why that I teach, as I hope that many other monks teach, that to really be able to overcome that delusion, that avijja, to see things clearly, one has to overcome these five hindrances. And it's a waste of time to think, to perceive, to view, that you can know truth, reality, and depend upon what you experience as truth, when these five hindrances are still acting, they are still at work. Even when these five hindrances have been abandoned temporarily, again, that sometimes that what you experience can still not be absolutely truthful. And the reason is because you have to abandon these five hindrances again and again and again to weaken avijja. Using the Buddha's simile of the five hindrances as something which is the food, the sustenance of avijja, by cutting off these five hindrances, you're starving avijja. You are weakening it until the time comes it's just so weak that you can push it over. What actually pushes over avijja, what sort of destroys it, the first destruction of avijja, is always said to be the words of an Aryan, together with one's own reflection, going to the source of all this. But you need to weaken those five hindrances, first of all. Sometimes that people think that whatever they see, whatever they hear, whatever they think, because they see it, because they hear it, because they think it, that it's true. One of the most useful investigations into delusion is using what we were talking about last night as the vipalasas, to see how one's whole cognitive process, and by cognitive process I mean the way one views the world, the way one perceives the world, and the way one thinks about the world, to see all of those three mutually dependent on each other, and to see that once one of those is in error, it makes the whole other two in error. And that error is self-supporting. Once there is a view which is not truthful according to reality, it bends perceptions to fit the view. And it bends thoughts according to your perceptions. And the views are bent. You might say they're constructed out of so much thinking, so many thoughts. And it's hard to be able to break that cycle. But that cycle is called avijja, delusion. How often is it that because of your views, or even about Dhamma, that you perceive in a particular way, and that perception is real in the sense that it's actually appearing in your mind? And so you trust appearances. Sometimes people say that that bare experience, bare sensation, is seeing things as they truly are. But anyone who knows the vipalasas, anyone who's seen through the delusion of the mind, knows that even what you perceive is not the way things are. It's the way you imagine them to be. The perceptions are unreliable. How often have you been fooled by perceptions? Even pages of a thesis, you get them the wrong way round. Perception, that's all. You're perceiving what somebody says, what they mean. In daily life, in ordinary experience, you know that your perceptions can sometimes trick you. If that happens in ordinary life, on things which are concrete, how much more likely is it that you will misperceive metaphysical realities, whether it's the nature of the body, whether it's the nature of thought, whether it's the nature of will, the nature of consciousness, the nature of the mind. How easy it is to misperceive those things. So you can't really rely upon such perceptions and thoughts and call them insights. So often, monks especially, whatever comes into their head, they call them insights and they go and give Dhamma talks about them. But you should not give Dhamma talks, you should not believe such insights. You should check those insights against two criteria. First, are those insights coming up based on samadhi? And are those insights coming up based on the Buddha's teachings? I say that those two criteria are necessary because the Buddha said again and again, and nobody I think doubts that this is truth, that yathā-bhūta-yāna-dasanā, the wisdom, the insight, yāna and dasanā, according to the way things truly are, yathā-bhūta, arises as a result of samādhi. Samādhi-pachaya yathā-bhūta-yāna-dasanā. And the samādhi which is meant there is always the samādhi which is free from the five hindrances. And as you've heard me say before, the only time you really know those five hindrances are overcome is after the experience of jhanas. That sequence which you meet again and again in the suttas, because you meet it again and again and again, it gives it more authority. It makes it more unlikely it could have been some mistake or could have been added by somebody or something. That the only way to be sure that it's yathā-bhūta-yāna-dasanā is first of all it's based on the experience after jhanas. And the only way you can be sure that the five hindrances are abandoned is that you've experienced that jhana and now you've come out. So often we have this word called upachara samadhi, and people quite rightly take that to be sufficient to arouse reliable insight. And the upachara samadhi is defined quite rightly too as the absence of the five hindrances, but not in jhanas. And the point is that nobody really knows what upachara samadhi is unless you've gone into those jhanas. You only know the entrance to a house by knowing the house which lies next to it. Otherwise, you may take anything to be the entrance, even though the house is many miles and miles away. The neighborhood can only be known by what it's next to. So I'm afraid that many monks even, they're good meditators, but they don't go deep enough. And they get to a stage and they think that what arises in that stage is insight and can be relied upon. It would be much better if they kept on going deeper and deeper and go through the upachara samadhi, which is before jhanas, and into those jhanas, so that their mind can experience the bliss of those states and they would know for sure that this is a jhana. And when they come out afterwards, they will know that this state after jhana is what is meant by upachara. And you know that the five hindrances are absent. You'll understand what that means. You'll understand just how deep those five hindrances are. That's why that sometimes you read in the books that the first hindrance is sensory desire. What does that mean? Does it mean like just lust or thinking about food? A lot of the time, most of the monks of this monastery aren't thinking about lust or thinking about food, but they've still got sensory desire, first hindrance, present. You don't realize just how deep those hindrances go, the subtle forms of those hindrances are still working, just right up through even the nimitta stage of meditation. And it takes a lot of courage, a lot of letting go, a lot of resolution to keep on going enough to go through those five hindrances into jhanas. When you come out afterwards, then you'll know for sure just what those five hindrances are and what it's like when they're not there. And that's the stage where at least you know that samadhi has happened, the five hindrances are temporally not there. It's a place where insight can happen. And if insight happens there, at least you can tick it off. The first criteria is insight born of a mind which has just emerged from samadhi. Samadhi pachaya. That could be yathabhuta jnana dasana. It could be seeing things as they truly are. Avijja has been weakened there. However, even just after a jhana, you may not see things as they truly are. Here you've got to check it with the Buddhist suttas to see whether what you see there is in accordance with what the Buddha said and what all the arahats for the past 25 centuries have referred to as the authoritative teachings. One of the reasons we can trust the suttas and the Vinaya is because anyone who sees that Dhamma will look back upon those recorded teachings and just to say, that is what I've seen. As the Buddha said, no different. So those two criteria there is where you can find out what insight is. It also means that what appears outside of that can be useful, can be helpful, but you can't really trust it. The vipalasas can still be active. The vipalasas, because of views, perceptions, thoughts, making more views, bending perceptions. And it's incredible just how powerful that can be. With those views, wrong views, not seeing clearly, comes up the defilements of desire and aversion. So often when we are not in a state of upachara, when the mind hasn't developed samadhi, you can see just how much likes and dislikes affect perceptions and thoughts. We only perceive what we want to perceive. When we don't perceive what we don't like to perceive. There have been many experiments done in psychology on this point. One which comes to mind was an experiment done in Harvard University a few years ago, where the experimenters were showing a group of volunteer students images flashed on a screen. They had a notepad next to them to describe what they saw. At first, the images were flashed up so quickly they could make no sense out of what was shown. It was just too fast to register a coherent image on the retina and to be made sense of by the mind. Little by little, by small increments, the experimenters lengthened the exposure on the screen of these images from a thousandth of a second to a few hundredths of a second through a few tenths of a second, more and more and more, until the students could think they understood what the image was. And they kept on extending the exposure to 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, until they'd find out exactly what their image was, and to check it with their first impressions. So often their first impressions were wrong. Perception jumped to a conclusion. If I remember the report about this, they gave the example that one of the images which they flashed on the screen was of the steps to a well-known building in Harvard, which every student would recognize. However, it was flashed so fast that one student couldn't recognize it at first. And then it was flashed a bit longer, a bit longer, and then he thought it was a sailing ship. Once that perception was in his mind, as the length of exposure was increased, that perception remained. Even to a point where an ordinary person, the exposure would have been enough for them to see quite clearly it was a building at Harvard. He continued to look at it, to see it as a ship. The initial perception had created a view, and that view was still strong enough to bend reality. And so even when it was a couple of seconds long, the sort of exposure which anyone would see, it was a building, not a ship, he was still seeing it as a ship. It was a very good example of the Vipalasas. But he also said the image which took the longest for people to recognize in this experiment, the one which their mind continued to reject, was something which was disgusting to the students. The image was just two dogs copulating. And they couldn't see that for a long time. You know why? Because the mind didn't want to see it. So often, likes and dislikes, or fixed views, I'm sure it's a ship, makes us see the thing as a ship. We don't like to see this, two dogs copulating, so we just don't see it. The image has to be right in our face, long periods of time, and then finally we admit, yes, we were wrong, and it is something I didn't want to see. It's basic psychology, but it's also part of Buddhist Dhamma, the Vipalasas. And so how is it that we can be sure that what we're actually perceiving, what we're thinking, what our views, how can we be sure that they are right? Are all views got the same value? And the answer is no, there is such a thing as right view, and there is such a thing as wrong view. And the only way we can know it's right view is to make sure The five hindrances are gone, so that which bends perception and bends thought and bends view, likes and dislikes, are all eliminated. It's as if, after a jhana, you don't care whether it's dogs copulating, whether it's a boat, whether it's a building. You've just got no vested interest in what you see. You've got no axe to grind, no view to protect, especially no person to protect. You need to get that sense of freedom of inquiry to be able to break through avijja. So often we think that our mind is free. We're free thinkers, we can think what we like. But so often we're not free, that we are imprisoned by our views. We're imprisoned by our likes and dislikes. And they do not permit us to see anything which challenges our likes and dislikes. You all know about dogmatic religion. Why is some religion, or some philosophies, or even in science, why are some scientists so dogmatic that they're right and everyone else is wrong? And the reason is because they're in prison. Their views, their likes and dislikes, prevent them from seeing the other person's viewpoint, or to see something other than what they want to see. They can't see what they don't like to see. So for us, we should always reflect upon that, to make sure that we don't trust our views if we haven't gained jhana. To don't trust our perceptions, our thoughts, if the five hindrances are still working. You can't trust any of that. You might look at someone, you monks, and think that's a beautiful girl. That perception has been bent. Why is it people like to get into lust? Because it gives you a sense of being someone. It gives you something to do. It takes you away from the initial, from the underlying suffering of existence. You're doing something. You're escaping. There is a sense of happiness and pleasure there. And so perception decides, or rather the defilements change perception, just to give you a little bit of a buzz for a few minutes. It's been bent, it's not true. Or why you get into ill will and anger against somebody? Why do you do that? Because you want to. Perception has been bent by your likes and dislikes, your wants. So we have to be very careful not to trust that. So if ever you get angry to anyone, anywhere in this world, don't trust that. If anywhere you really like somebody, anywhere in this world, don't trust that. Perception has been bent. It's not truthful. If you don't trust those things, you're going to be lessening craving and attachments. And you're going to be able to weaken the hindrances. You're going to make the attainment of deep meditation more possible. You're going to be able to get into jhanas. And then you're going to be able to really strengthen the real view, the right view, because you've got nothing to prove. In particular, the avijja is not just about being deluded about the nature of your beings in this world, not just being deluded about the body. It's also being deluded about the mind and how it works. The Buddha talked about five khandhas, and only one of those khandhas is the body. There's four khandhas. Vedana first of all, and then perception, and then mental formations, consciousness. And that's very important, to get into those and to see that those are also not me, not mine, not a self. That they are also impermanent. They rise and fall. and also they are conducive, or they are suffering, dukkha. It's important to see that. But of course we don't want to see that. Who wants to see that this body and this mind is anicca? We want to continue on. Sort of really stupid people think they can continue on in this body for 80, 90, 100, 120 years, 150 years, keep on going long, long, long. Why would you want to do that anyway? One of the moving stories in my youth, there's a movie which I went to watch, it was Dracula. But this movie was called The Thinking Man's Dracula. It had a message to it. Dracula was immortal. The only way he could possibly die was to be caught out in the sun's rays. If he only went out at night and hid during the day, he would last forever. And this whole movie was based on the struggle within this character Dracula between being so bored of life but so afraid of death. After 300 or 400 years, he'd done everything, been everywhere, experienced everything there was to experience, and he was bored out of his fangs. I was going to say skull. And eventually, there was nothing else to do. He allowed himself to get drawn out into the early sun's rays to die. People who want to live long, 200, 300, 400, what do you want to do that for? Even 40, 50, 60 years, many people are already bored, stiff, got nothing else to do. But sometimes people think they want this body to go on forever. It's complete delusion. They just want to be. Some people want this mind to go on forever. What do you want this mind to go on forever for? What are you going to experience with a mind anyway? Experience happiness now, suffering later on. There's no way that a mind can just experience happiness, 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 happiness. As I said so often sitting here, that happiness is just the gap, the pause between two moments of suffering. Suffering is a pause between two moments of happiness. Happiness is conditioned by the suffering which went before it. Suffering is conditioned by the happiness which went before it. If you lose happiness which was very wonderful and beautiful, then that's suffering. If terrible suffering finishes, that's happiness. So the mind cannot just experience happiness all the time. It's impossible. Any reasonable person can see that. It will only experience happiness and suffering. Nor can it experience just in between nothingness, neither happiness nor suffering. That's like a dead log, doesn't experience anything. No change means death, means finished, gone. It's not being anymore. It's as if it's just a rock, just nothing. No meaning. So why would we want this to keep on going? The reason is because there's something deep inside of us, the craving to be, bhava dhanha, which bends our perceptions and thoughts and views to try and give some little place somewhere in samsara. Even if I know that the big ego is not going to be there, at least the refined ego, or the cosmic ego, or the underlying ground of being, or whatever else you call it. Just people just struggle, they just want somewhere, some little place where I can be, something of me left afterwards. That's bhava dhanha, and that bends everything. This is called delusion. This is how delusion works. Why would people want that to keep on going? When we look upon anicca, we've got to see it completely. The same as when we look upon dukkha. We're in denial about suffering. Isn't this a wonderful world, wonderful people, a wonderful monastery? It's very hard, shameful even, to admit that this monastery, this body, is just a mass of suffering. People don't want to admit that. Psychology, it's denial. It's like looking at those two dogs copulating. We just don't want to see that. No one wants to see suffering. Suffering by its very nature is repellent. It pushes you away. However, that if one has the courage, which is born of having been in deep samadhi, you don't have any desire or aversion to what you see. And you look upon this body, you will just see just how it is completely unreliable. That happiness and suffering in this body just dance around each other like two inseparable lovers. You cannot part them. And you just realize that this body with its five senses is just an irritation. And if only you can let go of this body and the five senses, you go to the bliss of the jhanas, and that's far more beautiful. You see everything in the five senses as dukkha. Not only that, you should be able to see that everything in the mind is dukkha. If the citta is there, there is dukkha. So why would a person want to actually to keep anything of the five khandhas? It only is because of denial, because we haven't seen dukkha completely. In the Dhammacakka Sutta, which we just chanted, the Buddha said that we should contemplate dukkha until we see it absolutely completely. Parinyata bhang, fully knowing it. We can only do this to see what we don't want to see when we don't have any wants. After a jhana, the mind is that strong, it can go in to the five aggregates, can see them without any resistance. Once the five hindrances are there, you can contemplate any of those five aggregates and there will be a resistance. No, I don't want to see this. This can't be right. This can't be true. The likes and dislikes, the attachments, are stopping you seeing the truth. After jhana, no likes and dislikes are there for small time. You can go right in to the body. You see it, there's nothing there worthy of celebrating, worthy of keeping. You can go right into the five senses. Even in their most beautiful, wonderful form, they're just suffering, not worth anything. You go into thoughts and see just all these thoughts are just so much just stupid waves on the beautiful, peaceful lake of the mind. Not worth anything. Just so much empty talk. You can look upon Vedana, just see it as happiness, suffering, coming and going. Can't have one without the other. You look at perceptions and just see just why the mind chooses one thing and rejects another. This is what perception is of all the things which you can see and all the ways which you can see it. Why is it you always perceive it in one way? Why do you perceive it in that way? The reason is because that's what you want to perceive. And sankharas, their thoughts as well, will. Where does this will, where does it come from? It's frightening, so people tell me, to say that the will isn't you. It's completely conditioned, that you are not in charge. There's not a person inside you at the switchboard deciding what to do. It's frightening because it gets at something we don't want to give up. Our sense of being, our sense of me and self. We look at consciousness, the mind, and go deep inside of that. And see that mind. See it completely, fully. And understand that that too, that which knows, is not me. It rises and falls. That's a hard one to see. People don't like to see it. As the Buddha said in the Nidana Sanyutta number 61, people can pretty easily give up the attachment to their bodies. The people who give up the attachment to the citta are very few. People can see the citta as something which arises and passes away, which is not substantial, which is empty. They are few. They are Aryans. 61 Sutta of the Nidana Sanyutta. We don't want to see that. But you get into a jhana. You come out of that jhana. And then you'll have no predilection to any view. You have no likes and dislikes at that time. You'll be able to take a look at that and check it out for yourself and see. Once you have that freedom gained from the jhanas, not only can you investigate deeply, but you can hold that investigation for long enough to bore right into the subject. Another reason why avijja, delusion, continues to mask the truth, continues to blind us, is that very often whatever we focus on as a subject of insight is moving too fast. We cannot really see it clearly, because as it moves, we move with it. The mind is just too restless. Sometimes insight is like trying to hit a moving target, which is going at 1,000 miles a second. That's called the mind. The mind just moves so fast. First of all, when that mind is very still after a jhana, an attention can hold its focus on that mind for hours and hours and hours. Then you can bore into that. Sometimes it takes a long time to get to know something. I've given a simile before of holding up an object, and you've heard me do that simile before, holding up an object and asking you, what is it? And I do that because it brings out the way our mind works. We give it a name, and then I say, what else is it? We give it another name. I say, what else is it? We give it another name. And as we keep on looking, we soon get beyond the old labels. We exhaust the labels. All those labels, like views and perceptions, thoughts which we've learned, they're old stuff. Having exhausted all the labels, then we can actually start to see the nature of this thing. We bore further and further into it. And to see it as if we're seeing it for the first time. When you see the mind, you've got to get rid of all the labels of that mind. Everything you've been taught, and go deeper and deeper and deeper. Until you know what that mind is. Until you penetrate it. To penetrate it is just a shell. And inside, absolutely nothing. Ajahn Chah used to say, one, empty. If you're resisting this teaching, that's called vipalasa. If you get into jhanas, all resistance will be gone. You'll be able to go deep and see. You're seeing what you don't want to see, experiencing what you don't want to experience. That's why I always say that insights are those things which surprise you. They're not what you already know. If you already knew these things, you'd already be enlightened, you wouldn't need to practice so hard. You wouldn't be subject to suffering, you wouldn't be getting upset, you wouldn't be getting caught up in things. What you're actually seeing is the complete emptiness inside. The result of seeing emptiness inside is the untangling of craving and attachment. The simile which I've always given, which shocked me but which was very powerful, was actually to see that attachment has two ends to it. It's not just what you pick up, it's what is doing the picking up. If you imagine an arm, the fingers at the end there, that's the object of attachment. Now, the hand picking something up. But go in the other direction. What is actually doing this picking up? Go back across the tendons to the muscles along the nerves to the brain back to the mind. Why are you picking this up in the first place? Who's picking it up? What's picking it up? What is doing the attaching? What is doing the craving? That's the only point where craving and attachment can be fully overcome. Not at the point of the hand. It's too late down there. It's where all this picking up is coming from. The doer, the knower. When you see that is empty, there's no one there, there's no thing doing the doing. There's no person, no person at the switchboard. Once you see that, the emptiness of everything, no doer, the will is just a phantom. The jitta, the knower, the mind, a phantom. No one there. When there's no one knowing, then you can let go of knowing. Nibbana, or rather parinibbana, can happen. The cessation of everything. As long as you think a knower is absolute, permanent, essential, always has to be there, there can be no letting go of knowing. If you celebrate and delight in knowing, you will always celebrate and delight in suffering. And you'll never be apart from suffering. To know is to suffer. Whether it's knowing on the level of the world, or knowing deep in the mental states of jhanas, that's something which is a powerful insight, which can only come up as a result of jhanas. And that's what you see in the glorious Buddha's teachings of the suttas. Avijja is not seeing things clearly. Avijja is natural for the majority of people on this planet. The only way out of that avijja is to gain jhanas. And how do you gain jhanas? Through samma ditti, samma sankappa, samma vajja, samma kammanto, samma ajiva, samma sati, samma vayama, samma sati. The seven supports of samadhi. This whole eightfold path. The first seven factors are to support the practice of samadhi. Support it until one gains those jhanas. That's the eighth factor of the path. And once that eighth factor is realized, you have the opportunity to see things as they truly are. You've got the space. And with the Buddha's teachings, remember what I said about the two things which now come together, the words of another, and your own investigation which goes to the source. I've been talking so far about your own investigation which goes to the source. The only way that investigation can go to the source is when the hindrances are gone. When you've got the power to get right to the centre of this jitta, this vedana, this knower, this doer, this body. Go right to the centre of that. To have that power, you need the jhanas. And when you've got the words of another, the words of who? The words of Ajahn Brahm, the words of the Kubo Ajahn, the words of this monk, certainly not the words of you. If you don't trust any of those, or if you've got doubts, at least you can go to the words of the Buddha. Those are the most trustworthy. Get the words of the Buddha in your mind. Get into a jhana. Hindrances are gone. The words of the Buddha are there. It's a gunpowder on the match. If you stay long enough after the jhana, You're looking deep with the words of the Buddha in your mind. That is how stream winning happens. The insight will arise to you that that which you took to be a self is completely empty of any core, any essence. You can see the whole five khandhas are just a phantom play, rising and passing away one after the other. And there's nothing in there, absolutely nothing. You can just see just the way they create the suffering. And the stronger they are, the stronger you identify, or the stronger they identify with themselves, just the more painful is that experience of life. And the longer you have to go through this samsara. And you see there's nothing in there. You know the reason why the Buddha sometimes said this wasn't annihilationism, because there's nothing there to annihilate. How can you annihilate a phantom when it's not really there? Once you see it's not really there, it's about to go, it's about to disappear. When you actually see that there's nothing, no one in here, and that's called being a stream winner. Just, you know, as a direct result of that, you can see why the Buddha said only seven lifetimes at the most. Because the core has been seen to be empty. There is no doer. There is no knower. It's a process, arising and passing away, dependently originated, causally produced. That which is the nature to arise is the nature to cease, Kondanya saw in the Dhammacakka Sutta. You know that the samsara for you is mortally wounded. You cannot keep on going too long. Desires and aversions are just, the rug has been pulled out from underneath them. They cannot stand up very longer, much longer. Or like the simile I gave in one of those talks about a bird that's flying off from the tree, but you've taken a tree away. There's no place where that bird can land. It can fly up and down for seven lifetimes until it gets more and more tired, having no place to land. Craving and attachment have got no place to land once the illusion of self has been seen, once avijja has been overcome. You see the complete emptiness of this, dependently originated are all things, from vijnana to citta. Citta arises as a result of nama rupa. With the cessation of nama rupa, there's a cessation of citta. So says the Satipatthana Samyutta. So you can see the ending of things. And seeing that ending of things, you know that samsara for you is circumscribed. You are like that bird. You may be still flying around, but you know there's no place to land. That the five khandhas are going to die. The death of the five khandhas is called parinibbana. Well, these five khandhas just cease without remainder. They cease never to arise again. The last body, no more body. The last vedana, no more vedana. No more sanya, no more sankara. No more vijnana, no more citta. All gone. That which was of a nature to arise and pass away has arisen and passed away for the last time. Parinibbana. Pari means complete, all around. Nibbana is the same word used for the flame going out. It's gone out completely. Gone. So this is the overcoming of avijja. That's what delusion means. I call it delusion because we take something which is real, our experience, to be other than it truly is. We do see or rather there is seeing. We say we see, or we see an object. It's just seeing, it's just hearing, it's just smelling, it's just tasting, it's just feeling in the body. There is just mental activity with no one doing this. Just one event arising, passing away, and causing the next event. This causal sequence of sensory experience, but nothing going across. This is all this is. Or as the Arahat said, just dukkha arising and dukkha passing away. Once the Arya sees sensory experience, sees there's nothing, no basically point to it. You see that it is suffering, an irritation on emptiness, on nothingness. So this is what you can see, but we take that to be something it isn't. We build up this whole edifice of views that this is me seeing this. This is me feeling this. It's me doing it. I'm in control, I'm in charge. I'm the knower, I'm the doer. And because of that we build up the whole mass of suffering and of rebirth. Having done and seen, experienced so much in this life, we're not finished yet. We want to do and see, experience some more in our next life and the next life. We want to go up to the heaven realms. We want to check out even the ghost realms. We want to do so much. Seeing, doing, coming and going. Once you get to that illusion of the self, and see just how you were deluded, that what you took to be you was just a process arising and passing away. What you took to be a mind was just a process rising and passing away. Then you can understand that from that, seeing things as they truly are. That's Yathābhūta Jñāna Dasana. In all the suttas, the Buddha said that Yathābhūta Jñāna Dasana is seeing the five khandhas, not me, not mine, not a self. Once that happens, samsara is on the way out for you. And that's why, once that's completely seen, that's why that the person says, kina jati, that birth has been destroyed, because the cause of birth has been destroyed. When you know the causal sequences, that's why you can say, birth has been destroyed. You know the cause is gone. You know why that cause had made birth. You see the whole process. The process has been seen for what it truly is. Instead of being deluded, taking it for something it isn't, you see it for what it is. And that's called vijja. That's sambodhi, enlightenment wisdom. So be careful with avijja. Avijja just starts as just on views, perceptions and thoughts, and just on ordinary things, getting it wrong. Don't believe those things. But go deeper. Don't just mess around just trying to get by in this life, trying to be a happy person or a successful person. Please aim for nibbana. Just go for the whole thing. If you want to go for the whole thing, then just suspend all of your views, perceptions and thoughts until you've had a good jhana or two. In the meantime, if you want to make sure you don't make bad karma, follow the Buddha's teachings, what the Buddha says in the suttas. That will keep you on track until you get into a jhana and see those things for yourself. And then you too could be enlightened. So that's the talk this evening on avijja, delusion, and how to overcome it.